This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba is here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and of course some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you'd like to talk with Zorba, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. A line open right now for you at 800-462-7413. And along with our calls, our topics.
Yes, we're going to talk about childless couples. People without children, do they eat healthier or not? Okay. Interesting data from the UK that may really reflect on what's going on in America today. And we're going to talk about quackery and vaccines, the autism MMR vaccine connection, which is quackery. We'll talk about exactly what the scientific malfeasance is about.
That's one that's been floating around for quite some years.
We'll find out
some more about it and our recipe.
Red onion greens with turkey bacon. It's delicious, it's low fat, and it's yummy.
Okay, I'll take your word for it, at least for now. 800-462-7413 to the phone, Zorba, and a listener now in Springfield, Missouri. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how can we help?
Hi, okay, I have a question. My heart recently has been racing in some weird ways. It's almost as if someone were to come around the corner and scare you and you get a burst of adrenaline. And it has been happening maybe like the last 6 or so months, and I'm not sure if that's something I should get checked out or what could be causing it. Have no history of this. And then my senior year of college, kind of graduating in May, moving cities after that. So I thought maybe it was anxiety. I'm not quite sure. I've cut out caffeine. So I'm not sure what's causing it.
How fast does it beat and how long does it last?
It's just like as if someone were to like pop out and scare you and you get that burst of adrenaline and then it kind of goes away after a little bit.
Got you. So in other words, so this is a sudden fast heart rate, sudden fast pulse that occurs without anything going on. Let's talk a bit for a second about exercise. When you exercise, is your pulse, you know, abnormally fast? We can tell when our pulse is abnormally fast. Do you do any exercise?
I do. I run every morning. And no, I mean, nothing usually.
Okay. Good. Good. Now with exercise, that's good. Have you noticed it when you're lying down, when you're going to sleep, you know?
Sometimes, yeah.
Uh-huh.
More recently, not initially.
Well, let me tell you what it may be. And first of all, you can't tell without either something called an event monitor or something called a Holter monitor, which is what you wear to try to pick up these fast pulses. There's something called supraventricular tachycardia, which means a fast pulse usually originating from the top part of the heart above the ventricles. The ventricles are the things that kind of pump the blood into our heart. And above that part are things called the atrium. And SVT, which is a common thing, it's not an uncommon thing, but it's pretty common, can be these bursts of fast heartbeats that occur for 5 or 10 seconds. Sometimes they'll actually occur for 15 minutes, 10 minutes, an hour. In other words, for some people, they can occur for quite a long period of time. And there are treatments for it. There are medical treatments for it. There are other treatments for it. But a fast pulse that kind of occurs suddenly, you often want to know what that is. Now, in somebody who's older, and you're obviously not older, you're with college and graduating college, it really becomes a very serious thing because we want to make sure it's not something called VTAC, which is a fast pulse that can be problematic, you know, because you're not getting exactly the pulse your heart races, but it doesn't produce the pulse that we want to have. But this doesn't sound anything like that at all. Let me ask a question. Are you still under health insurance?
I am, uh-huh.
Okay, because that's an important part. I think what you should do is this. You got to call your family doc or your primary care physician, nurse practitioner, you know, PA, whoever you go to. Tell them about the pulse. You should go in and get a regular EKG, a regular electrocardiogram. Sometimes that'll pick things up. If that's normal, then you need either an event monitor or a Holter monitor. Now, a Holter monitor you wear for 24 hours. An event monitor you wear, and when you feel the fast pulse, you push a button. And what it does, it's continuously measuring you, but it doesn't actually record it unless you push the button, and then it goes back about 3 minutes, 3 to 5 minutes. In other words, prior to that, it's always recording, but it's just not actually keeping it in a permanent record. And what you want to do is catch the pulse to see what it's about. And those are the two different ways. And I would recommend, and I'll tell you why, these, as you know, isn't this a little bit disconcerting when it happens?
It is. And I thought maybe it was just anxiety with finishing college. And so I've tried to cut out things that I thought maybe it might be caffeine.
Good idea.
I've been trying to sleep well.
Good idea.
Consistently, but it just hasn't gotten much better. So
no, and you know what anxiety is. I mean, we all have a fast pulse of anxiety, but it's usually not at 150 beats. For most of us, you know, that's like a real shot of adrenaline. But I don't think that's the issue. I think you've got SVT, SVT, V as in Victor. I think that's what you have. You need to be monitored to see what it is. And then if you have it, there are a variety of different treatments. Either they ablate the area of the heart that's actually doing it. They do a little electrical charge and get rid of it. Or sometimes just medication, something called a beta blocker, will do the trick too.
Awesome.
Good luck. And congratulations on graduating college.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 800-462-7413. Before our next call, Zorba, you brought in a study comparing adults with kids and adults without kids and their diets.
That's right. That's right. So let's look at the adults without kids.
Okay.
So they're living together. They're going to the store. They're having a wonderful, quiet meal. That's not what the study was about, but it's kind of what I picture as adults.
Yeah, you think about
children.
It.
Yeah, and it turns out,
and they
out,
don't have to worry about kids, so they can get really healthy foods and eat whatever.
Yeah, that's it. They can have a nice, quiet meal.
Yeah.
And it turns out these were 7,000 couples in the UK. They found that those adults consumed 4.4 pounds more per week of fruits, or per 2 weeks of fruits and vegetables. In other words, if you don't have children, you'll eat more fruits and vegetables. Now, let me tell you, if you have children, what do you eat? Dairy products, cereals, and potatoes. Now, what do kids love?
Yeah, like you said.
Dairy products, cereal, and potatoes.
Yeah.
And so it turned out that was really what the issue was. And the question was, essentially, is there a difference? You know, adults who have children, in other words, parents, say, well, I'm going to teach my children to eat fruits and vegetables. And the answer is, they're probably not doing that because they're probably not buying the fruits and vegetables.
The kids are kind of controlling the family diet.
Right. Yeah. And kids will basically give you a terrible diet.
Yeah.
So parents, if you want to have a good diet, what you're going to have to do is pay more attention to fruits and vegetables. But overall, if you want to eat healthier, maybe the answer is don't have children.
800-462-7413.
And let me tell you, as a parent, you'll live longer if you don't have children.
Now, that's not true. Back to the phones. A caller with us now in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help you?
For about the last 7 years, I've had issues with dehydration, and it's gotten worse, and I've tried to even change what I eat, cut out starches and carbohydrates, because I heard that takes more water to digest. Nothing is changing this.
So how much water do you drink?
I do the 8 glasses a day.
Wow. And what are the symptoms, the dehydration symptoms?
Dry eyes, headaches. My throat's always dry.
Mm-hmm.
I can't drink alcohol or pop because it just hurts.
Mm-hmm. So no fruit juice, no caffeinated products, soda products,
nothing.
Just water. Uh-huh. Now, you have a vaporizer in the house. Do you humidify your house?
No.
That may be part of your issue, first of all. When you're laying down, when you're sleeping at night, you've got, 6 hours, 7 hours, 8 hours, 9 hours. People get dehydrated during that time. You know, they're not drinking, and what happens is the air is dry. And in Oklahoma, as you know, the air can be very dry. It can be very moist at times, but it's often very, very dry air. So you may be dehydrating your mucous membranes. Your mouth, your nose, your eyes are all being dehydrated at night. So my first recommendation out of the box is get an ultrasonic humidifier for the bedroom. And you put it in the bedroom, and the ultrasonic makes a smaller particle. It's quieter than a cold air, a cold air humidifier. You can take a regular humidifier in the house and turn it up so the windows steam. But frankly, most people don't like to do that throughout the entire house, and I think the bedroom should be as moist as you can. That's number one. Okay. That's number one. Number two, you don't have to drink anything besides water. Water's just fine. I mean, you don't have to have fruit juices, you know, which essentially have calories. You don't have to have milk, which has dairy products. Water is just fine. And there's no magic number to the amount of water that you need to have. What you need to do is sort of look at how you're urinating. Now, you know, if your urine is a light color, it means you're hydrated. If your urine is concentrated, and we all know what a concentrated urine mm-hmm. looks like because we all have that, where it's a dark color, it means you're not drinking enough. I'd kind of base it on that. I wouldn't okay. base it on anything else. I would look at my urine. I would make sure I'm urinating every few hours. And if I'm not, then I would drink more water. We've become sort of water crazed in our society. And part of it, I think, is really driven by the water companies who have sold us bottled water, you know, saying that it's better than water out of the tap and we should be drinking all the time and flush your kidneys. You don't really flush your kidneys. That doesn't really exist. It's so I think moisturizing the room, drinking enough water to keep yourself hydrated. Now, eyes. If your eyes bother you and they're dry, eye drops are great. You want to get liquid tears. They're more, they essentially are a little tackier than Visine, as an example. There are a whole bunch of different lubricants for the eyes. Some are quite a good lubricant and some are a very watery lubricant. You find one that's aesthetically pleasing. That's what you should okay. do. That's what you should do. From your mouth point of view, if you find that everything burns but water, drink water. That's perfectly fine. But you've got to moisturize the air, I think, part of your problem. I'm against diets which are terribly limiting. I mean, a standard vegetarian diet and a standard vegan diet and a standard omnivore diet are fine. But I think some people get into a macrobiotic type diet, which, by the way, is terribly deficient in vitamin C. Scurvy, the only scurvy recorded in this country practically, is from a macrobiotic diet. So I think eating plentiful fruits and vegetables in variety is really a key issue. And of course, cutting down on the saturated fats, meats, and poultry that we eat too much of. So good luck. Let us know. Moisturize the air.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate the call at 1-800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, a listener with us in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi.
Hey there. How are you guys?
Fine. What's up?
This is regarding a very dear friend of mine. Last year, it started off, she contracted pneumonia and stayed sick with it for a good couple of months. It hit her pretty hard. Her immune system weakened a fair bit, of course, from it. And she seemed to get over it, but she never got back to 100%. Very shortly after, I'm talking within a few weeks, she felt like she was coming down with it again. Went to a doctor, got some blood tests run, found out she got mono. And this, again, hit her pretty hard. It weakened her immune system even more, and she stayed fairly weak and very, very low energy for a good couple of months. She felt like she was finally getting over it, but she still didn't feel 100%. So she goes back to her doctor. They run more tests. Find out now she doesn't have mono at this point, at this stage. She has the Epstein-Barr virus. And she's still been relapsing from it and just can't seem to get over this, no matter what they've tried, no matter what her doctor has told her. I'm hoping that you guys can provide some insight into this and possibly some suggestions.
Sure. First of all, the Epstein-Barr virus and mono are the same thing. I mean, the EB virus is what causes mono. But let's look at a few things. First of all, when you get pneumonia, pneumonia is a serious disease. It is always one of the top 10 leading causes of death from infancy to old age. In other words, and when people get pneumonia, it's a serious thing. And often they don't recover. They take 3 to 6 months to recover. They may be over the pneumonia from the chest x-ray point of view. You may not hear crackle and things called rocci in the lungs when you're listening to the lungs, but it pushes them back. It puts down their immune system. It's a very serious disease. Now, mono test is very interesting. If you do a mono test, if it's positive, you may have had mono 10 years ago. I mean, once it's positive, it stays positive. It doesn't necessarily ever go negative. Sometimes they'll do monoviral titers, and if the titer is increasing at a certain rate, then you can tell. And we rarely do that, but we can tell if there's an acute mono infection. You do a titer, it's called, now, measuring the amount of antibodies, and then 2 weeks or months later, you do another titer, and if the antibodies are rising exponentially, it implies your body is actually sending out those antibodies. That's what we measure. To the monovirus. When we measure mono or EB virus in the blood, we don't actually measure the virus. We don't measure it at all. So if she's had a blood test and they say she has the EB virus, it means she has antibodies to the EB virus. Doesn't tell us anything at all about the acute episode. Now, for a lot of people, there used to be something called chronic EB viral infections. Is there really something like this where they can measure the virus in the bloodstream? Because something's called chronic infections. HIV is a good example of a chronic viral infection that's deadly that we can't get rid of. They've never found chronic EB viral infections in people. They've never been able to actually prove the virus just stays there and is in the body and is doing its bad deed. That scientifically has not been shown to be the case.
Can I ask you a question about that?
Sure.
What would be the symptoms if she was having that chronic infection?
Well, we don't have evidence that that disease actually exists. That's kind of the point. In other words, we don't have any evidence for that. Now, there's some people believe that people have chronic fatigue syndrome, CFS, actually is caused by the EB virus. Maybe it is. There's no proof of this because there are people who have CFS, chronic fatigue syndrome, who are EB virus negative, mono negative. And it might be that chronic fatigue is caused by a variety of viruses. It might be a catch-all diagnosis whereby a number of viral infections then push down the immune system and people have difficulty actually getting up and doing things. And I do think chronic fatigue syndrome is really there, really exists because people have it. So I think we don't know what she has. I think that's kind of the bottom line from my read of the information. However, let me just give a recommendation. One thing we know is that antidepressants, even if people are not depressed, sometimes help people who have this particular problem, even if they're not depressed. Now, is it because it's regulating the serotonin? Maybe, but even the non-serotonin antidepressants such as bupropion seem to help too. So you don't have to be depressed to try an antidepressant, and that's what I would recommend for somebody like this. Try that for 6 weeks and see what happens.
Okay.
Good luck. Good luck to your friend.
Zorba, thank you much. And I did want to say I'm a big, big fan of your show.
Well, thank you so
thank
much.
You.
And we appreciate the call. Before the break, Zorba, you may want to enter your chambers because it's time once again for Judge Zorba.
We're the trumpets.
No trumpets in a courtroom.
I want trumpets.
No.
How about a gavel? Do I get a gavel?
This isn't medieval England. This is in a modern-day courtroom. Today's case comes to us from Michelle in Chesterfield, Missouri, and it concerns the HCG diet. I'll turn things over to Michelle Esquire. She writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba, I'd like to ask your opinion to help settle a debate between my fiancé and I. He really wants to go on the infamous HCG diet. Meanwhile, I'm skeptical about it. His mom and dad are an RN and DPM, respectively. They both feel like the diet is based on sound medical principles. I have brought up the fact that the FDA does not approve its use, stating that it is unsafe. But my fiancé counters with the fact that obesity is the biggest health issue in the country, basically a cash crop for the pharmaceutical industry. Of course, the FDA wouldn't approve something that would kill a major industry," he says. What do you think?
Well, first of all, I mean, the FDA, I don't think the FDA is in the pocket of industry. I mean, there have been lots of issues about that, but the fact is there are no new obesity drugs approved by the FDA because all the drugs, when we look at them, when they've been tested, have had side effects. Fen-phen, great drug, worked well, caused heart disease. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. People lost a lot of weight on fen-phen. If we look at Rimonabant, which was a drug approved in Europe, there were people who lost 50 to 75 pounds, great drugs. The problem with the side effects were suicide and suicidal thoughts. So when we look at pharmaceutical drugs used for obesity, they haven't been good. Now, HCG is human chorionic gonadotropin. It has no scientific basis at all.
Thanks for saying
for
that,
the reduction.
It's supposed to be infamous. I never heard of it. What is it?
For the reduction.
What happened?
The idea is that this is human chorionic gonadotropin. It's produced. It's essentially used as the it's a pregnancy-related hormone that is produced by women in the body. And for some reason, people have said, well, let's produce it ourselves. Let's produce it and let's inject it into people and they'll start to lose weight. It has no scientific basis. Now, just because your mother-in-law or father-in-law happens to be an RN and the other a DPN, which is a doctor of podiatric medicine, even if they're an MD and a PhD, it doesn't mean they're right scientifically. No. It has no scientific basis. And I'm always concerned about drugs that are used in sham science. If you want to go and use something that is not a drug and you want to go on a food-related diet, I think that's okay. I think there's safety in food. But once you start to inject things, then there's not the safety that you need and there may be side effects from it. So I'm against it. I don't think the diet is good. I don't think it's scientifically based. And I do not recommend it.
I mean, there's so many good diets. Just, you know, be careful what you eat. Lots of fruits and vegetables. Why would you want to inject something?
Well, because it's hot, because it sells, because people make money on it. It's just like colloidal minerals. I mean, there's a big – I mean, if you look at health books and health-related books, 10 or 20% of them are related to obesity. It's big money.
Yeah.
So it's not just big money from big pharma. It's big money from people writing books and selling HCG. So I think HCG is quackery. Quack, quack, quack.
Well, don't let diet divide you.
Quack, quack.
Add your case to the Judge Zorba docket by sending your affidavit or email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have our recipe coming up. More of your calls, of course, some more interesting research, our medical myth buster as well. Right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our number again is 800-462-7413. We have callers waiting, but we have an open line for you right now at 1-800-462-7413. But before our next call, Zorba recipe time, this one for red onion greens with turkey bacon.
That's right. Sound good to you?
Well, I'm not a big greens fan.
So greens are not your thing. What did your mother call a vegetable?
Well, we had vegetables.
Yeah,
we talked about this before. You know the standard. Peas, corn.
That's it. Like four vegetables.
Beans.
Three or four vegetables.
Yeah,
squash?
No.
No, squash. No, squash. Sweet potatoes.
And salad was, head lettuce.
Yeah, head lettuce. That's what it was.
Actually, lemon juice for dressing. That was my mother's.
Lemon juice. That's what she liked. Just plain lemon juice?
Yeah.
And there, out of the bottle?
Not the bottle, from a lemon.
Oh, from a lemon.
Bottled lemon. What are you talking about? Bottle.
Just trying to figure out what she was like.
I got it.
Lemons. They come from lemons. They don't come from bottles.
Right.
Greens are great.
Yeah.
A different variety of greens are great. And what we want to do is look at things. These are collard greens. Now, collard greens, are very common in African-American cooking. And they're something that are very, very useful. They're also common all over the South.
Yep.
They're not common I never saw collard greens until I was in college. This is an example of how to use collards.
Okay.
And collards can be quite, quite tasty. And I would recommend, if you've never had collard greens, that you consider this recipe. I mean, it's a great way to introduce yourself to it and see if you
would
like
you acknowledge that just a plain old collard green isn't anything to write home about.
Absolutely. I would acknowledge that. Yeah. Well, of course, look at lettuce. I mean, who eats lettuce without lemon? Look at your mother. Yeah. She gave you iceberg lettuce, and it wasn't anything to write home about. Where did that phrase come from, write home about?
Well, that just means it isn't worthwhile.
Thank you.
It's something that's really, really good.
I didn't
want to write home and say, hey.
I always wondered what that phrase was. It's nothing to write home about. Yeah. Red onion greens with turkey bacon.
Right.
Okay, and we're using turkey bacon because it generally will have less fat and it's made of turkey.
Right.
Okay, start out with 1/2 pound of turkey bacon chopped.
1/2 pound of chopped turkey bacon.
That's right, chopped turkey bacon. 3 medium red onions chopped.
3 medium red onions chopped.
And we use red onions because they are?
Colorful.
That's right, colorful, because they're red.
Yep.
You can use regular onions in this. 1 1/4 cups of chicken broth.
1 1/4 cup chicken broth.
That's right, chicken broth, which is good. Always use the low sodium. It actually has more taste to it because they have to put more chickeny flavor into it when they take away the sodium. 1 1/4 cup of apple cider vinegar.
1/4 cup of apple cider vinegar.
That's right. 1 1/4 tablespoonfuls of dark brown sugar.
1 1/4 big tea, dark brown sugar.
1/2 teaspoon of hot red pepper flakes.
1/2 tea, hot red pepper flakes.
And 4 pounds of collards chopped.
4 pounds of collard greens chopped.
That's right. And when you chop the collards, make sure that some of the ribs and the stems are discarded. You want the leaves, basically. That's what you're going to use with the collards.
Okay.
The leaves are going to be washed and drained well. Mm-hmm. So let's make the recipe. In a heavy pot or a kettle, at medium heat, cook the bacon in batches until it's crisp and then transfer it to a paper towel. Reserve some of the bacon drippings at the bottom of the pan, and that's what you're going to use to saute the onions and brown them until they're nice and browned and soften, and then transfer the onions to a separate bowl.
Mm-hmm.
Now, add the broth, vinegar, sugar, red pepper, and 1/2 the cooked bacon to the pot. Stir it until the sugar is dissolved. That won't take very long at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then toss in about 1/2 of the collard green leaves and cook until they're wilted. Then add the remaining collards and toss it, and then simmer the whole thing for about 30 minutes. When you're just about close to the end, stir in the red onions and then simmer for another 30 minutes. It takes a long time to cook collards.
Mm-hmm.
And then top the collards with the remaining bacon and serve.
Yeah,
and you will have a wonderful collard green recipe.
So is this like a main dish?
Not at all. Well, you can use it as a main dish if you were a vegetarian. Of course, it has bacon in it, so it's not going to work if you're a vegetarian. Yeah, you could use it. I think of this more as a side dish. That's what I would think.
What would go alongside it then?
Ribs. How about ribs?
Ribs?
Yeah, would you
and
like
this.
Ribs? Ribs and collards?
I love
anything
ribs.
With beef? How about brisket?
But you already have bacon in this, so you do want another meat to go along with it?
I don't know. What would you have with this as a side dish?
I would have the ribs without this.
Wait a second. You would have ribs without the recipe. That's not what the show is about. It's what's going to go with this. So
this sounds delicious to me. How can I actually find these ingredients and put this together? If I haven't paid close attention.
Clearly, you just want ribs. But this is red onion greens. It's a good recipe.
Okay.
It's a good way to try collard.
Okay.
You could have it as a side dish for an egg salad sandwich. How does that sound? An egg salad sandwich with red onion greens and turkey bacon.
On white bread.
173 calories. And total fat is 10%. But this has quite a bit of protein in it. 23% of the protein needed for the day.
Assuming anybody really wants to do this, how would they?
People who like collards.
I know.
There are a number of people who like collards. Well, I mean, it's very easy. All they have to do is come to our website, zorbapastor.org. If they go on our website, they can find this recipe, they can find our archived recipes, and they can sign up for our weekly podcast. That's zorbapastor.org.
+1 800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. Now to Oliver Springs, Tennessee we go. Hi.
Hello, gentlemen. How are you today?
Well, we're fine. We're going to see if we can get around that Tennessee accent as we talk. how can we help you?
Well, I was listening to the show recently, a recipe from the archives for pork sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
And all was great until the end when Zorba said, It could be served on a muffin, which his grandmother used to call a crumpet.
Okay.
And as an official member of the language police, I am calling to prefer charges.
Okay. Explain the difference to us.
Well, there's a lot of it, but essentially a crumpet in England, not to be confused with a crumpet in Scotland, which is different, is a, in its semi-cooked state, it's round and rubbery, and anything less appetizing is hard to imagine. It's a mixture of flour, water and yeast. In fact, my grandmother used to call it wind and water. And also baking powder has been added, and the baking powder in rises and causes it to the top side of it to look like a sponge.
So it's not the same as a muffin?
Nothing like. So then you toast it, and now you can put something on it. You put butter on it as a base, and it soaks into it like a sponge until you bite into it, and then it drips out the bottom all over the front of you. And when I was a kid, it was always served with something like syrup or preserves on top, but you can also put a poached egg on it, and it's eaten at any time of the day.
Well, you make it sound so appetizing. I have to run right.
I think it's the butter dripping out the front down the shirt that I find the most appetizing part of this.
But they are delightful. But I'm not sure that I'd want a pork chop on top of that.
Well, thank you so much for filling us in. You know, it's always the grammar police and the food police that are just the most important part of the show.
How long have you been on this side of the pond?
Oh, nigh on 40 years.
Oh, my goodness. Well, thank you. We appreciate the call very much and the correction.
Yes, absolutely.
My pleasure, and I'll be continuing to listen. I'm a member of WUOT in Knoxville.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks again.
Thanks for listening, and thanks for the tip, and always give us the tips when they are worthwhile.
Zorba, before we head out for a short break, it's time for another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. A listener named Bradford takes serious issue with your oven thermometer advice. He writes, "You've stated several times on your show that stove ovens are typically 30 to 50 degrees off temperature from their settings and that a separate oven thermometer should be used to gauge the accurate temperature. This is simply untrue. For the last decade, stoves, both gas and electric, have incorporated digital comparators to check that the temperature set, these days programmed in, is matched by the real chamber temperature. Also, these comparators are much more accurate than the old analog gauges still sold as oven thermometers. You need to join the 21st century."
I think you're right. I do need to join the 21st century. I'm a Luddite. That's it.
No, you're not. No, that's not true.
By no means. By no means. Well, the books that I read, the magazines that I read, Cook's Illustrated being really, I think, one of the premier magazines for cooking, if not the premier magazine on the market today, talks about the fact that ovens are still off. So even though it's digital, doesn't mean it's real, doesn't mean it's true. And so I think I'll stick by my guns. I'll be respectfully disagree and say I'm going to continue to use my analog thermometer. Now, it's true, I do not have a new oven. My oven is 15 years old, so I don't have the new electronic oven. On the other hand, I've used electronic ovens in new households. My daughter being one of the houses I went to, she had a new oven and went and bought an analog thermometer for her oven. And it turned out the analog one read completely differently than the one that was actually on the stove. So I think I'm going to stick by the Cook's Illustrated advice, which is get a separate thermometer in the oven. No reason not to recheck, since you want to make sure your food is cooked accurately. And I will respectfully disagree. And as you mentioned, Tom, I am not a Luddite.
Yeah, no, you're not. And he uses the word comparators, which is not a familiar word to me. The meaning seems to be that there's some sense of comparing what the temperature is compared to what the gizmo is. It makes little sense.
Well, when you have an oven in the old, certainly in the oven that we have in our house, what they are doing is you set a dial, hold it in an analog way, and it goes up to, there is a probe in the oven that's measuring how hot it is.
Right.
And so what this person is saying, that what it's doing is that you've got two different contraptions. One basically turns the heat on the oven, and the other is actually measuring the heat in a comparator. A device. So it's a different way of doing it. Yeah. One is electronic. But electronics are not necessarily more accurate over time. They're just electronics. I mean, a digital clock is not necessarily more accurate than an analog clock that is set correctly. So once again, I think I'll fit with the Cook's Illustrated advice. And I would recommend that you still put a separate thermometer in your oven that you can check.
Well, if Zorba's advice is raising your temperature, let us know during our next edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. Just send your rebuttal to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have another interesting topic to talk over. Some more of your calls, of course, our medical myth buster too, here on Zorba Pasture on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again is 1-800-462-7413. But before our next call, it is time for another topic. And this one, Zorba, I know you have a lot of knowledge about because you've talked about it before, autism and vaccines.
Right, autism and vaccines. Well, let's look back at a study that was done in Great Britain back in 1998, published in the journal Lancet. The journal Lancet is an extremely prestigious journal, right up there with the New England Journal of Medicine and JAMA. And there was a scientist by the name of Dr. Andrew Wakefield, and he published research that showed that there was a link between MMR, measles, mumps, and German measles vaccine, and autism. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, throughout Great Britain and throughout the U.S., the number of parents who said, well, we don't want our kids to get MMR vaccine, obviously if that's a risk, we don't want to take the risk, plunged. The number of measles cases skyrocketed. Mm-hmm. The number of children who died from measles, because measles can produce death, increased significantly over what had been before.
This was huge. I remember
huge,
when it happened.
Big issue. And it turns out the research was forgery. It was quackery. It was junk research. It was garbage. It's now been retracted by the Lancet. The doctor had been, quote, dishonest. He lied. I mean, dishonest is really not the right word. He lied. He's a quack. And basically, the research is junk. So now the problem we have is that there are a number of people who then say, well, I believe that MMR vaccine causes autism based on this 1998 study, and it's junk.
Yeah,
it's garbage.
And the trouble is now the study is long enough ago that it's almost ingrained.
Ingrained, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, and we can say now it's found that this guy was a quack,
right.
But there are a lot of people that are still not going to...
A lot of people who make money off of this. I mean, there's a guy named Jim Moody, he's director of Safe Minds, a parents group, and he's in charge of that, and I'm sure that Mr. Moody probably gets a salary, that's my guess. There are other people who get salaries on this, or they've just decided that it's, for whatever reason, they've decided it's true. But the initial research was based on quackery. And so it's fake. It's not real. There's been overwhelming evidence that MMR vaccine does not cause autism. There's also overwhelming evidence that there's an increase in autism. And the fact is, we don't know why, but it's not the MMR vaccine. And I think that parents have to look at this and say, okay, now, do I want to get my child vaccinated or not? I think it's still an individual decision, but the study is junk science.
Yeah, so don't base your decision, whatever it is, on that.
That's right. Now, if you want to base your decision on whether or not you want to vaccinate your child on something else, you should do it. I mean, I think it's your right as a parent to do that. But I think there's a risk of not vaccinating your child for measles. That's the biggie. And I think the junk scientists say that it's connected to autism. We don't know what causes autism, but it's not MMR.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. Back to the phone, Zorba, and a listener with us now in El Paso, Texas. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for getting my call in. This is pretty exciting.
Oh, it's exciting for us, too. How can we help?
Well, I saw a segment on a news report on male menopause, and I kind of gravitated towards that because I'm reaching 50,
mm-hmm.
and I'm noticing things about myself, and I wanted to know if you guys know anything more. There's not that a lot of information about it, so anything would help.
Oh, sure. Let's look at male menopause. Let's look at menopause, first of all. Menopause
okay.
is a specific word for women that implies what we call, actually, scientifically, ovarian failure. In other words, the ovary produces eggs so that women can become pregnant, and there's estrogen and progesterone that's produced. And then over time, the ovaries stop doing that. And women go through a very, very specific episode, which is a climacteric, it used to be called, and it's menopause, and it's a very specific thing. And so for years, physicians gave estrogen. We would give oral estrogen, and we said, well, you can stay young forever. Everything will be fine. All you have to do is take estrogen. It'll work well. And lo and behold, the HERS, H-E-R-S-1, and the H-E-R-S-2 studies came out and said, well, wait a minute, there actually are side effects. It doesn't protect against heart disease. It doesn't protect against cancer. It causes heart disease, and it causes stroke. And so the drop in estrogen prescriptions following that was precipitous. Now, is there a male component of this? Well, we know that testosterone over the years tends to decrease in men. In some men, it decreases more than others. And so men immediately, the testosterone industry, if you would, pharmaceutical industry, got on the bandwagon and developed different forms of testosterone. Prior to this, the only way to get it was by an injection. Now you can get it by something called androgel, where you put it under your armpits because it absorbs better. And it's a topical testosterone that does increase the testosterone levels. The scientific community, for the most part, has said we don't think there really is a male menopause. There is a drop in testosterone, but there's no evidence scientifically that when you give larger doses of testosterone that all of a sudden men have more energy, have more sexual energy, have more vigor that they have with that. And there are really very few studies on this. Some of the studies that have come out years ago have really been discounted as not being really very good science that's up to date. So for the most part, I don't really think there's a male menopause syndrome that's out there. There's a big industry, by the way, involved with this. There's, you know, we're talking about $500 million or $1 billion a year drugs from the major pharmaceutical industries. And then if we look at the complementary pharmaceutical industry, it's probably another $500 million, $250 million. So there's a lot of money out there for advertising of this. For the most part, I don't think there's really any good evidence. And I worry about testosterone supplementation because I worry about the cardiovascular side effects from it. In other words, I think the drug is not benign. I think if you want to take complementary and alternative medicine, that's pretty benign. But I worry about testosterone and the fact that it may cause heart disease and stroke.
Okay. Well, good. Thank you so much for your help.
Well, you're welcome. Good luck. I think if you're looking for more energy and you're 45 or 50, I think you have to look at other things. Lack of energy is a common problem in our society. It's probably, after chronic pain, it's probably the number two question that I get in my office from patients. How can I get more energy? And my answer usually is, how much sleep are you getting?
Yeah.
You know, you need 8 to 9 hours of sleep. So if you're only getting 7, you need more then. Good luck.
Hey, thank you very much.
Sure, we appreciate the call. Thank you. And time now, Zorba, once again for our medical myth buster. Today's myth deals with a common home remedy for sore throats or coughs. It's one our producer swears by. Now, let's put it to the test. Is it true that a teaspoon of honey can help cool a sore throat or ease a rough cough?
Absolutely, it is true. teaspoon of honey is good. Now, let me give you a few caveats. Honey should never be given to children under 1 year of age, period. Not at all, ever, because it can cause infantile botulism. So until your child reaches a year of age, you don't use honey. But there have been a couple of studies. So the first study, the first study that's been on the, that's been around, or rather the study that's most recent that's been around, was supported by the National Honey Board or something like that. And they looked at honey to see whether or not honey worked, and the answer was yes. It reduced the cough. But if we look back at into the fact that around 2003, 2004, they looked at honey, they looked at liquids that were sweetened liquids, they looked at cough syrup that we don't give to children under the age of 2 anymore because we know that cough syrups really are not healthy for children. And lo and behold, it turned out that honey was really the best thing. And there's just something about that sweet syrup that goes down the back of the throat that seems to reduce cough. So I think a child after the age of 1 is okay to have honey, and I think, frankly, honey is good for adults to have. I like the taste of honey. I don't think it matters which honey that you have. I think honey is great. What do you think? Do you take honey for your cough?
No. I just kind of cough through it for a while.
I think it's really an issue with kids that are coughing at night. That's exactly it. So yes, honey is good, scientifically proven. Use it over the age of 1.
Yeah, I only have 1 honey, by the way.
You only have 1 honey.
If you have a myth that may be too sweet to bust, send it to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
It's 800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. And a listener now in Bozeman, Montana. Hi.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we appreciate the call. What's up?
I have a nodule in my thyroid. I've had it for about a year and a half at least. They found it because I had a neck injury, and in an MRI it showed up. It's really tiny. It's about a centimeter long. My first doctor had watched it. They did ultrasounds every 6 months, and it didn't grow. Then she said she wanted me to have it biopsied, and I really wanted to get more information, so I saw an internist, and the internist also said that he would like me to have it biopsied. So my question is, are there any risks of spreading cancer to the rest of the body by having a tumor biopsied? And the reason I ask this is because I watched a TED lecture by Dr. Lee, who said that all of us have tumor cells in our body and that they only become problematic when they develop a blood supply.
Let me answer question number 1 first, and then let me talk about this concept. A thyroid nodule, the cancer will not spread if you have the nodule ruptured and the thyroid cells are spreading around the thyroid. Thyroid cancer is common. It's not uncommon. It's curable, absolutely curable in the early stages. We have ways of evaluating which nodules are more likely to be cancer and which ones are not through scanning techniques. And if the recommendation is to have the thyroid nodule biopsied, my recommendation is get a biopsy. No doubt about it. Zero doubt. Zero question in my mind because, as I said, it's a common cancer. How old are you?
36.
It's common cancer in early age. It can kill you, and it's curable in the early stage. So I definitely think you should have it. Now, let's get back to whether or not cancer is spread, and then I'll talk about this tumor cell concept. There's some things where the cancer is spread. Ovarian cancer, certain forms of ovarian cancer, when you open up the belly and remove it, should be removed whole because in those cases, those particular cells can seed in other parts of the abdomen. So that is a very specific type of cancer where you have to be very careful when it's removed. That's a very specific case, does not correspond to thyroid cancer. Now, let's look at cancer cells themselves. We know there's some cancer cells that don't, that are there and they don't spread. Prostate cancer is the perfect example. If you take a 75-year-old man and you look at their prostate, they die, we'll say, of a heart attack or stroke, 75 or 80. A lot of them have prostate cancer and it never spread. If we look at abnormal cells in the body that are, quote, cancer-like throughout the body, there are a number of cells that may be cancer-like that simply sit there and don't do anything. So there are some people that say, well, there are cancer cells all over. Why should we bother removing them if they're simply in the body? Well, The answer is, for instance, if you have an abnormal mammogram and there are cancer cells there and you remove them, the risk that you're actually going to develop cancer are very minimal. If you leave them in the breast, the risk that you'll develop cancer are pretty high. So it's a cost-benefit ratio. And there are these abnormal cells throughout the body, and when we do biopsies, sometimes we'll find them, but we don't do anything about them. Prostate being a good example. In Europe, they don't do anything about it. They watch it. Thyroid, very specific thing. If it's abnormal, you want to get it treated because the risk that you're going to develop cancer is really high.
So it kind of depends on where it is in the body.
Mm-hmm. Depends on what the cancer, you know, depends on where the cancer is in the body and what it is. But thyroid cancer, extremely curable. And once again, you know, what are the chances you have it with an abnormal test? They're up there, but we can't tell for sure without the biopsy.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Good luck. Let us know what happens.
Okay, thanks.
And thank you for the call. Before we get out of here for the week, Zorba, I want to share this note I received from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox. It came from Darwin in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and it concerns our show podcast. Darwin writes, "Tom, I want to let you know of a curious phenomenon. I have an MP3 player that gives me the option of listening to podcasts at an increased speed. When I experimented and listened to a recent broadcast of you and Zorba, here's what I found. Zorba's voice is intolerably high.
Absolutely.
Since my own voice also jumps to a higher pitch when I'm excited, I never could find fault with or tease the good doctor, but listening to Zorba this way would be intolerably comic, I'm afraid. The strange thing was your voice, Tom. When sped up, your cadence and pitch, which normally is casual and personable, becomes the staccato stylings of Mr. Regis Philbin." "Exactly like him. Amazing that your voice doubled in speed could sound so similar to that television personality. First I'm Adam West, and now I'm Batman.
Regis, and now you're Regis Philbin.
Love the show," he says, "and I hope this doesn't make you too self-conscious."
So who would you rather be, Adam West or Regis Philbin?
I don't think I'd want to be either one of the above.
I wouldn't mind being Adam West. I think that's okay.
You'd like to be Batman?
You could be Robin. Thank you, Tom.
Even at double speed, our advice can help. Let us help you. Just send your lifestyle questions to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org, and don't send me those tights.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Executive producer Adam Friedrich and technical director Brad Kohlberg, who look as ragged as Mick Jagger and Keith Richards today, are WPR's two Rolling Stones in charge of this hour. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. I'm Tom Clark for Zorba Pastor, hoping you'll join us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0122Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.